Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, 26th of August, 2020, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined as usual by Phil Bishop, editor of the Construction Index daily online news service. You're having a good week, Phil?
I am. It stopped raining here. Sun's sort of coming out, and things are good. Looking forward to Bank Holiday Monday coming up. We have Monday off.
Ah, good gracious. I'd forgotten about that. Well, I'm supposed to be having a day off today, actually. I'm not in my usual location in Devon. I'm actually in Abergavenny at the moment, having a few days away. But for a lot of yesterday, we were confined to quarters because a huge storm blew in. It's nice outside today, but yesterday would have been the ideal time to be doing something like this.
Sounds like you're having the typical British holiday experience.
Indeed I am, yeah. Well, you lead off, Phil, because I know that you've got certain things you want to start with.
As usual, we've got three topics on the agenda for our chat this week that we can chew over and mull over. And the first one is the news that the... We put the kibosh on this one ourselves, didn't we?
We did.
Last week we said how well the Thames Tideway Tunnel, the super sewer in London, was going in comparison to Crossrail. Crossrail, yes. We said, was in difficulties because of all the complicated train technology stuff, controls involved in it, whereas the super sewer is a simpler piece of infrastructure by and large. I mean, it's still a hell of a project construction-wise. Yeah. But it turns out that COVID has put the kibosh on their programme and costs. The organisation behind it disclosed this week that their latest modelling indicates that construction work, which had been due to be completed in 2024, is now likely to take until the first half of 2025 to finish. Nine months have added to its schedule. And there's no suggestion, they haven't said anything about technical difficulties. It's purely to do with the, there was a shutdown and delays during the COVID lockdown for a few weeks. And then they came back to work at most sites, but with reorganised working practices, with social distancing and everything. And like so many projects, it's hit productivity and they can't do quite as much, quite as quickly as they have been doing. And the knock-on financial effect of this, revised completion date adds £233 million to the previous budget forecast, taking the estimated project cost to £4.133 billion.
Not exactly a drop in the ocean, but not a massive cost overrun.
I think it's fairly significant. I think the good news is that my understanding is that the end customers, which is the Thames Water... I was going to say ratepayers, but the water bill payers in the Thames Water area in the capital, it doesn't add on to their bills. I think there's a peg, I can't remember what it is, £25 per quarter, month, something, that they've been told they're going to have to pay extra, or maybe they even are already paying extra for this big sewer. That, I think, is pegged, and therefore they're not going to get stung for this extra cost. The shareholders have to bite that one.
But I think it's worth noting that the delays that have affected Tideway are very different from the delays which affected Crossrail. I mean, not only are the delays a lot shorter, but it's not been caused by, well, as you said yourself, it's not been caused by sort of operational difficulties or technicalities. It's actually pure and simple, the effect of the lockdown. And it's the only big infrastructure project I've heard that has been hit by this so far. I don't know if there are any more which are going to be affected. HS2, for example.
HS2, for the difference with HS2, two things. I mean, I think the Euston Works, I think, were impacted in London. It hadn't really got going hugely. And a lot of HS2 around the country is more sort of earthworks and setting up in remote areas and so on. The problem with Thames Tideway is that it's all in London. And it's getting people to work on the tubes has been the challenge in the capital. They're doing the job. It's the logistics of getting people there and and home again.
Yeah.
But we assume, we have no reason to believe that there are any technical difficulties. But we said before, rather cynically, that COVID does present an awfully convenient rug to sweep a lot of other things under, should anyone be so.
We're not suggesting that that's the case here, but it's,
No, I know what
you mean. So mea culpa, because I think we were saying how wonderful Tideway was and it was staying on schedule and everything. Only last week, that was a little bit premature, to say the least.
But the delays to these projects leads us very sweetly, radio on DJ Segway style, onto our next topic, which is the elimination of delays in projects. Now, Department of Transport has set, or is setting up, end of next month, I think it starts live in October, a new unit, the Acceleration Unit, to speed up transport infrastructure projects. Transport Secretary Grant
has nobody ever thought of that before? I mean, major infrastructure projects have a bit of a habit of being, falling behind schedule. There's nobody ever noticed this before and thought maybe we ought to accelerate things.
Have they got any fresh ideas? Well, we don't know that yet, but I think the freshest idea is bringing in someone who, judging by his LinkedIn profile, we have no reason to expect that he knows anything about either construction, engineering or planning. He does seem to know about transport. He's a campaigner. The guy's going to head this acceleration unit for the Department of Transport and get road and rail and big infrastructure projects built more quickly. It's a guy called Darren Shirley, not someone I've heard of before. I don't know much about him.
No reason why you should have done.
Well, I looked up his LinkedIn profile. He graduated with a degree in biomedical science in 2001 from the University of Kiel. So biomedical science is a good solid, sounds like he's an intelligent chap doing a proper degree rather than anything slightly flaky. But his career has been in campaigning roles and lobbying. He's worked campaigns officer for National Energy Action, campaigns manager for World Wildlife Fund, campaign manager for Which, and for the past 2 years he's been chief executive of the Campaign for Better Transport. So he's an interesting choice. I mean, my first reaction was what the bloody hell. And then I read his quote. He said that he hopes to bring a fresh perspective to things. I think on that basis, given that most of the time government brings in experts to look at things who have expertise and knowledge and form on these issues, maybe it is time for a bright, smart outsider with a clean slate and a fresh pair of eyes.
Well, it is intriguing because, I mean, as you said just now, that we don't know how they're going to accelerate infrastructure projects or how they propose to do this. I suspect maybe they have only the vaguest idea at the moment. I mean, they have got a panel of experts, haven't they, which includes some well-qualified people to be able to comment on this and perhaps put forward some ideas.
They've named two, and these guys are not going to, as far as we can tell, well, the two that they've named, the sort of expertise that they're going to lean on, that Darren Shirley's going to lean on, is the Highways England Director of Complex Infrastructure Projects, a guy called Chris Taylor, who oversaw the big A14 scheme, which came in.
Bit of a shoe-in, I would have thought, that character.
On budget. They say it came 8 months ahead of schedule, but I'm not quite sure which schedule. I think it came 8 months ahead of a highly padded, contingency-filled schedule. But it came in very satisfactorily, I would certainly say that. And on budget.
And we are constantly reminded of this, aren't we? We should say that the A14 crops up all the time when the government wants to tick a box or to promote its infrastructure development policy. The A14 is always there.
And the other name that's been put out by the Department of Transport is someone they're going to get advice from for speeding up transport projects is the increasingly ubiquitous Mark Reynolds, who's the chief executive of MACE. Now, MACE are a sound company, but you don't necessarily associate them with transport. You tend to associate them with complicated building projects like the Shard and things like that. He was involved in delivering Olympics, 2012 Olympic infrastructure, so he's got track record there. The Department of Transport press release said that MACE oversaw the construction of the Nightingale Hospital in East London in 9 days. I'm not quite sure how you can compare converting an exhibition arena into a hospital in 9 days to building HS2, but Mark Reynolds is clearly an increasingly important mover and shaker in the construction industry. He leads the skills working group on the Construction Leadership Council. He's one of the big noises behind the whole push for free ports, which the government seems to be picking up post-Brexit. There was an interesting privatise. I tend to throw away my privatises after I read them. I didn't used to have a stockpile, but I now throw them away after I read them. So I wasn't able to dig out the article they had. And it was not particularly, if anything, it's quite flattering to Mark Reynolds, actually, sort of bigging up his growing influence.
Yeah.
But it was pointing out the contrast that Mace has always been, it certainly used to be, I think, Mace had came to prominence in the
Tony 90s, Blair really,
years.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it seemed to be sit quite nicely with, you know, whereas some Tory party, some big construction contractors have been quite tied to the Tory party over the years, you think particularly McAlpine. Mace always seemed to be sort of a New Labour slightly friendly thing, but it's, and I can't find the document, but apparently Mace has written in its policy somewhere that it's not political and it studiously doesn't engage, doesn't do political donations. No. But Mark Reynolds seems to be increasingly the government's go-to man for a lot of things, in the way that John Armitt used to be not so long ago. John Armitt was, I think he's still head of the National Infrastructure Commission, which
yes,
we don't hear so much about these
yep.
days. Now, mention the National Infrastructure Commission, they might have been a good organisation to get involved
set
in the acceleration unit. certainly advise on that, but it's been kept completely separate.
Mm.
But you said, how are they going to do it? What are they going to propose, this the Darren Shirley's unit? Now, it seems to me,
I wonder what this fresh perspective is. I mean, his background is intriguing because, I mean, which, you know, the Consumers Association, Greenpeace, WWF, I don't know what Witch's perspective is on infrastructure. I don't suppose they really get involved with that so much. But Greenpeace and WWF certainly are quite anti-HS2, for example, HS2 being the big infrastructure project at the moment. I don't know how
I'm
long
not
ago...
Sure I'm not sure Greenpeace is, or maybe I'm thinking of Green Party. Certainly the HS2 does divide the green movement because there are the pro-trains side of the green movement. So there are divisions there. But yeah, his perspective, Darren Shirley's perspective, seems to be very much from the consumer side of things.
Yes.
And the word sustainability comes up a lot as well. So it's consumer perspective and it's the green perspective seem to be where he comes from.
Well, he comes from the campaign for better transport, which is, I think the idea is that, yes, we need transport. Let's do it better. Simple as that, really. But according to Wikipedia, of course, that font of all knowledge, the Campaign for Better Transport is a member of an organisation called the Right Lines Charter, which is an umbrella group of organisations, environmental and other organisations, which apparently supports the idea of high-speed rail in principle, but considers HS2 to be unsound. So it'll be interesting what he suggests we do about HS2. Presumably, I don't know, he's not going to come along and say we ought to scrap it. I can't see him doing that. But
I don't think he has a remit to advise on what projects go ahead or not. It's purely on speeding them up.
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me there are only three ways you can make a project get from conception to completion quicker. You can either speed up the planning, the procurement, or the construction. I can't see any other thing you can do other than speed the planning, the procurement, or the construction. The planning's already on the agenda for, certainly on the house building side, which is not transport, of course, but the planning reforms are coming for house building. Could transport projects be planned more quickly? Yes, they can, but only at the expense of removing some sort of democratic accountability test, checks and balances. So do we want to remove checks and balances? That's
probably
something
we're
going to have to look at. Procuring quicker, well, that can be done, but probably not much. I mean, there's been an awful lot of progress made in frameworks, and A14 was an interesting one. It started out as three separate contracts, and after the three contracts to three big contractors were awarded, the Highways England said, right, change of plan, you're all one team, you're all coming together, and it's all one big, you're in one big gang doing it together. And I suppose, had they known that from the outset, maybe that would have speeded up the construction side of things a bit. Build quicker. Well, I think any motorist who's driven down a motorway and seen cones and roadworks and unattended machinery sitting parked up at the side will think, why is nothing happening here? I mean, 9 times out of 10, you drive past roadworks on a motorway, nothing is happening.
Absolutely, yeah.
That can only be a question of money. I mean, so maybe it's just a case of spend more money to get it done more quickly. I don't think you can get more done for the same amount of money. You can always chuck more machines and more people at a job to get things done more quickly. And this is what the acceleration unit is all about. It's not about doing things more cheaply.
But as I said earlier, I mean, surely people have thought of all these things.
Yes, but they don't want to spend the money, I guess.
Surely people have thought of all these things in the past. I mean, it's the fresh it's still the fresh perspective that I find intriguing, because I don't. Speeding up infrastructure projects is the civil engineering industry's holy grail. We all know that time is money, and if you build a bridge, a road, a rail network, anything like that, the quicker you can build it, the cheaper it will be. We all know that these big projects, because they're very complex and difficult to organise, very often do run over budget and over time. So we all know that we need to speed things up, and surely everybody's we must have explored virtually every single option by now. But if he's got some new ideas, I'd love to hear them.
I did a little bit of reading around on this, and I did find a hint as to some of the things that he might be looking at, because Mark Reynolds' name was mentioned in the Department for Transport statement that he was going to be advising Darren Shirley. Presumably it won't be a full-time thing, it'll only be a part-time thing. He's still got Mace to run, another thing to do. And Mark Reynolds, in November 2019, before the last general election, wrote a manifesto for construction and the built environment. And this is on Mace's website. You can find it and read it in full. And within his manifesto for construction and the built environment, he said that we need to prioritise speed in procurement. I'll quote from this is his views of how we can speed up procurement. Despite what some people believe, it is impossible to run a perfect procurement process. The many layers of bureaucracy and compliance involved actually often bring little benefit in terms of the project outcome, but delay projects getting started and trip up organisations due to the complexity of the law. There is a balance between speed and supposed thoroughness. The dial is currently too much towards the latter and needs to be moved towards the former. In other words, we need to be less thorough, or supposedly thorough, and more speedy. He says, a future government should give a commitment that no procurement process should last longer than 12 months from invitation to tender to award. Now, of course, we're not going to be subject to EU procurement law, or we're not subject to EU procurement laws anymore. No. So the government, if it wants now, set legislation to say, right, we're just going to give every project to Mace and not bother going out to tender. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think there'll be some MPs, and certainly, you know, National Audit Office and people who care about accountability, will balk at the idea of thoroughness being sacrificed somehow.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
But Mark Reynolds clearly believes there's you know, we can kick out some of the thoroughness in our procurement and just give it to someone who looks, you know, looks good earlier.
Yeah, well, it's a very bold thing to say, isn't it? I mean, it's a brave man who says we should, you know, we shouldn't look at the detail quite so much. We should see the big picture. Something like an infrastructure project, I think you ignore the details at your peril, don't you?
Yes, I'm quite sure. But I suppose, and we've moved a long way with things like early contractor involvement, where they identify a contractor early before you really know the full detail and the scope of the project, and you haven't costed it, and then they get involved in the costing of it, and that speeds things up.
And that's a proven benefit, isn't it? We do know about that, but it's nothing new.
Exactly that. And there are other little details in Mark Reynolds' manifesto from November 2019, which may give a hint to the sort of things the acceleration unit may want to look at. Mark Reynolds says, it's better for large infrastructure projects to find a long-term trusted partner who is involved in the project from start to completion, bringing the whole thing together, incentivize the partner on the successful outcome of the whole project rather than one discrete element. which again sounds a little bit like the A14 approach. He says,
it does,
we need to create a panel of industry heavyweights outside normal public sector structures to challenge the project's scope, timescale and costs. Their sole role...
Oh, is that Mr. Shirley we're talking about?
No, this is before Darren Shirley came along. This is Mark Reynolds writing in the...
I know, but does he fit that description is what I'm saying.
Well, he's not an industry heavyweight, is he? Not in terms of construction.
He's not an industry heavyweight, no.
It sounds to me like creating another National Infrastructure Commission, another layer of bureaucracy to provide...
Yeah, duplicate. Yes, exactly. Bit of duplication. So, and who else is in this unit? I'd love to know that.
We don't know. I mean, I would hope...
We've got two advisors, but who actually...
I would hope that Darren Shirley gets to pick his own advisors. It makes no sense him given a job to do and not having any say over how he does it. I have no idea, but I don't know. How would you speed up projects? Well, if you wanted to build HS2 more quickly, what would be your...
You're not asking the right person, Phil. I really don't know. I mean,
But we've already gone through the planning and procurement of HS2, so it's only construction. So maybe we should take a hypothetical project which hasn't even been planned yet.
No, it's imponderable. I mean, I wouldn't know where to start, quite honestly.
More machinery.
I mean, we've had all these great ideas in the past about building a team and open book accounting, partnering, and really sort of consolidating the delivery team. Yeah, that works. I'm sure that's worked in the past.
More,
if you remember, BAA...
But that's more about cost control.
BAA were very good at that. Well, that was about cost control, but it was also about delivering on time as well.
Yeah, okay.
Heathrow Terminal 4?
Terminal 5,
yeah. So I can't remember how many terminals Heathrow's got. I mean, that was a big success, and there are others of that similar sort of vintage. But, you know, we're held up as, you know, exemplars of good project management.
But it's too easy to look at Heathrow Terminal 5 and say that's how to do it, because you've got a private sector client who, in terms of awarding contracts, can do what it wants. It's not accountable to the taxpayer, to Parliament, to the public. You know, it's got no political comeback if it screws up. So it's got freedom there to do what it wants. And secondly, it was a single greenfield site. It's not going through lots and lots of people's back gardens. It's not like building a new motorway between, you know, Falmouth and Arbroath or something. So it's a discrete, I don't know if you call it greenfield or brownfield, but, you know, physical, discrete site. In the private sector, so it's almost ideal conditions, except you've got aeroplanes going overhead all the time.
There was one public sector procurement body, wasn't there? I'm thinking of Defence Estates. They were a very successful. I don't know if they still do. I don't know if they're building anything.
That was not Faslane.
Public sector organisation.
Faslane was chaos, wasn't it? Procurement wise.
Well, that's true. Yes. I can't think of any of the Defence Estate successes, but I do remember them being hailed as an example of how public sector procurement should be used. But maybe it was a bit hit and miss. I don't know.
Now you suggested
getting back to Darren Shirley.
You suggested that Darren Shirley was a bit of a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah, possibly. We'll have to wait to see. I mean, certainly he doesn't appear to fit because he hasn't got the background, but maybe he will. You know, knock a few edges off and he'll fit in quite nicely. But I think you're going to segue into something something a little bit more lighthearted. Square pegs in round holes.
I was teeing you up for this.
Okay. Square pegs in round holes. Yeah, this was a story which appeared, which you posted actually on the website this year, this week, about the ex-boss of B&Q has decided to put his backing behind a new device, which actually, looking at doing a bit of research online, isn't all that new. It's been in America for a while. But anyway, it's a new device on the UK market for drilling square holes, which of course sounds like a physical impossibility, but apparently it is a thing. I haven't got the details in front of me, Phil. Do you want to tell us what it is, what it's called?
Well, it's an attachment to a power drill that looks, I suppose, not unlike perhaps a sanding attachment. It's a square block, and instead of spinning round and round like a drill bit would, this plate with edges that would cut out the hole goes sort of. I think it vibrates and goes backwards and forwards, I'll read from the blurb.
It's basically got like four...
It uses patented technology to convert rotary motion into linear motion in four planes at once, enabling the user to cut square holes.
It works on the same basis as, you know, those you can get those oscillating saws, which are used by electricians and plumbers for cutting through floorboards, for example. And have you seen one of these things?
I haven't.
It looks like the segment of a circular saw. So it's just sort of like a slice of pizza, if you like, with teeth on it. But instead of going round and round and round, they go backwards and forwards.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I mean, you can touch your own hand and it won't cut you because it's the teeth aren't moving very far. But when we had our rewiring done at home, our electrician was using one of these things. I was quite impressed because you just put it against the floorboard and it sort of vibrates its way through and it doesn't cut through neighbouring boards. And if it hits, say, some wiring, unless the wiring is being held down very hard, it will make that vibrate rather than cut through it. Anyway, this works in the same way. It's got four little blades arranged in a sort of rectangular sector and they just vibrate backwards and forwards by a few millimetres, 2 or 3 millimetres, I think. And really, I think the only application that I can see of this and the only application I've actually seen online is creating square holes to put electricity sockets in dry lining. So it's for plasterboard, basically.
Or for very, very small cat flaps.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. I suppose you could get a big one. You could get a big one. But the whole idea of a drill for square holes I found intriguing.
We should mention...
We should say who the chap is who's backing the idea in the UK.
Well, and also the people who make it and what it's called. Device is called the Quad Saw, Quadsaw. Uh-huh. The company that makes it is called Genius IP. The inventor is a guy called... These guys filed the patent for it. Forgive me if I'm pronouncing your name wrong. Tekel Michael Sabatu. And he's also got a patent for a dental flosser. So he's obviously a man full of ideas. And the former B&Q boss who has joined as non-exec chairman and become a major investor in it, we don't know how major, is a guy called Jim Hodkinson, who says it's the most exciting new product to arrive on the tool market for many years, he says. Wherever a square hole is needed, QuadSaw will be there.
I did see, I googled this, I found a YouTube channel, not a particularly well-known one, I'd never encountered it before, and don't ask me what it's called, but a couple of DIYers, or they might be electricians, might be professional electricians actually, testing out various different devices, and they do a demonstration of this quad saw. One's using just an ordinary pad saw, you know, you drill a hole and then you
work around
manually
it.
Saw out a rectangular hole for your socket. The other one uses this thing which makes an awful lot of noise and vibrates an awful lot, but there's no doubt about it, it is quicker. He cuts three holes in a piece of plasterboard before the other chap has even finished cutting his first one, so it's quick, and obviously that will help with productivity. So yeah, it does look like a really good idea. Of course, there's a question of the vibration and the noise produced by this device opposed to the relatively quiet, vibration-free process of doing it by hand. But I suppose that if you're not on a production line and producing thousands of holes a day, it's not really a problem. So I thought that was quite an interesting thing. And partly because I do know of a technique which is used in engineering to produce hexagonal holes with a drill. And
Is that done the same principle?
No, it's not actually. It's much, much simpler. There's a device called a rotary brooch. A brooch, I don't know if you know, a brooch is used in the engineering industry for creating square holes. And it's simply, it's like a square section file or a milling tool. And you literally push it through a round hole and it's tapered. And so as you push it through, it cuts out the corners of the hole and comes out the other side. You've got a square hole. And it's used for creating slots, holes,
so
all
you
the
start
rest of
off
it.
With a round hole and this tool makes it square. Is that the idea?
Yeah. You just by pushing it through, and it's not new technology at all. But you must have you ever put together an IKEA bed or chair or anything made by IKEA? You know, you've got your little
Allen key you're talking about.
Hexagonal key. And then you've got those screws which have a hexagonal socket in the back.
Yeah.
Well, that little socket which holds your hexagonal key starts off as a round hole, and then they come along with a little device which is rotating, but the tool itself doesn't rotate. It's an eccentric bearing which wiggles a hexagonal cutter. And this is a hexagonal cutter which is tapered back, rather like a lathe tool, so that you push that, it just fits in the mouth of the round hole, and you push it forward. And as the drill rotates, this thing wiggles. You know, if you're trying to sort of make a, just with an awl or something like that, make a hole in something, you don't just push it straight in, you wiggle it round, don't you?
Yeah.
It does exactly that. So it's called a rotary brooch. And that's how they, I mean, I only found this out within the last year. That's how they make the holes in Allen screws. They just use a rotary brooch. So square pegs, round holes, even hexagonal holes. It's ingenious, but that's the way
it's
done.
Anything else you want to talk about this week?
I think that's about it, really. There are other things going on. We noticed this week that there have been more redundancies announced at the CITB.
Oh, the other big story this week is the Highways England has published its five-year business plan for road investment period two, 2020 to 2025. Headline figure, 27.4 billion, but that includes maintenance and its own running costs and all sorts of things. Actual capital expenditure on improvements to the network, 14.2 billion will be spent over the next 5 years. For me, the headline is that the big controversial projects are still there. They're still in the programme, which is the Stonehenge Tunnel upgrade to the A303 there. That will start in the summer of 2022, currently. And the Lower Thames Crossing, the twin tunnels under the Thames in, is it Purfleet or somewhere like that? That will start in early 2023, according to current plans. So that's all going in. And the other less marquee thing is all the changes to the... Well, there's more smart motorway sections going ahead, and all the changes to the stuff which they got wrong before by not putting in enough refuge sections. They're putting in additional 10 refuge sections for stranded motorists in the M25 before the end of this year.
Yes.
10 extra. The whole of the M25 is not smart motorway yet, I don't think.
Only 10?
I may be wrong on that.
Doesn't seem enough to me. I mean, 10 extra ones. What's the? Can you remember what the spacing is supposed to be between these refuges?
They're then going to consider the impact of those for a couple of years before considering adding more in on other stretches of existing smart motorway. So we'll see what happens. And coupled with that announcement, Highways England Chief Executive Jim O'Sullivan, who's been in the job for 5 years, has said that he's handed in his notice and he leaves next year. No successor has been identified yet, or at least announced yet. And some newspapers rather mischievously coupled his departure with the smart motorway fixing news and suggesting that he's carried the can for smart motorway fiasco, which I think is probably overreading it. He's done a term and...
Oh, I see.
He inherited the smart motorway policy anyway. They weren't his creation. I mean, he certainly didn't make them any better, but he merely picked up the ball and carried on running with it.
Yes, that's right. So that's a bit of good news, I suppose, is that these projects which... Perhaps some people were worried might be...
Well, that's how I look at it, but equally I respect the fact that a lot of people look at it as bad news that these controversial projects are still going ahead. I think that's it. Yeah. I think we'll meet again same time next week, David.
Well, is that it for this week then, Phil?
We'll just tell people as usual, say thank you for listening. Do subscribe.
Yes, indeed.
Contact us, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. This podcast, Reconstruction... Subscribe to it and it will drop onto your device with delightful regularity. You can read more about some of the things we've been talking about at www.theconstructionindex.co.uk. But for this week, from David and myself, thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith and independent newsagents UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk /magazine.